I think it's interesting because Niklas Luhmann in Social Systems, I mean, he explicitly says that systems need to generate their own contradictions in order to keep moving. But he also said, you know, there's also, I'm going to butcher the quote, he says that, you know, this is the only way in which individuals have the potential to make the system move, is by being the contradiction within the system. So I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, it seems like the system can always recuperate contradiction, can recuperate noise into its own functioning, and yet the nature of that contradiction can also make the system move in certain directions. It's not always just a return to the same state. So I think that might be some way to start thinking about that. It's not a return to equilibrium. It's a change in some direction.
So, your mention of novelty is sort of like the progression kind of, if we're talking about cybernetics, brings to mind that, like, Terence McKenna program from the 90s where there was this, I mean, this is like, we're saying the metaphor, the prediction was, he wrote that, so Terence McKenna is this, like psychedelic group type, and he wrote this program in the early 90s, which was this measure of novelty, right? And the idea was that there's this inevitable course of civilization and this increase of novelty, and so in the computer program, he predicted in which the point of maximum novelty, right, and this falls on, like, 2012, right, and that's where a lot of, like, the whole 2012, like, phenomenon comes from, actually. And then sort of, like, the question I have from that metaphor is, like, that was sort of infused in, like, early 90s cybernetics type stuff. How does, like, this idea of at least from that era of cybernetics, how does it incorporate, like, the inevitability of, like, an increase in noise? And, like, how does, like, the system sort of respond to that? That might be an idea of utopianism, because that was sort of embedded in a lot of that thinking.
I mean, part of what's interesting to me is that a lot of the second-order cybernetics people actually retreated from these questions of, like, how do we, you know, what do we pronounce about society and pronounce about social organization? You know, Heinz-Hans Foster did this a little bit, right? He talked about inevitability in terms of sort of population, right? Exponential population increase, and had this kind of, you know, historical deterministic model. But very quickly sort of stopped thinking in those terms, right? They started thinking more about, less about, like, the overall design of society and more about, like, actually constructing, like, small concrete interactions between different people. So it's hard to say. I mean, I think this, you know, I think the idea of inevitability is an interesting one. I mean, I think it's the idea of a kind of, I don't know, but it kind of becomes like this kind of eschatological moment, right? And some of the sort of self-organization discourse, right, or especially around, like, networks on the internet, has that kind of, like, you know, we get density of links to a certain point and society is going to qualitatively change. But I'm not sure about it.
I mean, I'd like to pick up on what you're saying about how I think there is a huge amount that the Titkin piece does miss, but I guess then we have to sort of ask whether that, like, this new form of cybernetics is actually, you know, still has its liberatory potential, or whether it's just, like, even more of a problem. Like, for example, I read this text. I think I'll butcher the author's last name, but it's called basically "Coming Back to the End of History," and it seems to, like, basically posit that, like, since, like, the late 80s, we basically lived under, like, sort of, like, situationist, like, dictatorship. Basically, that now that, like, neoliberal capitalism has become so advanced that basically it, like, thrives off its of resistance to it, and that is the sort of primary motive for, like, you know, new like reorganization of capitalism. And I think if you look at that from a sort of cybernetic perspective, like, cybernetics is always sort of, like, you know, taken, like, it thrives off, like, you know, feedback, and what's better feedback than, like, you know, the people that are trying to, like, you know, destroy the system entirely, because they often have the best critiques. So I think, like, maybe there is sort of more of a sort of, like, focus on noise and thinking that noise is a good thing. It's something we need to have in the system. But if only to better sort of increase our like potential control, because we are getting this, like, you know, like we are getting the people out there in the streets, like, you know, giving us, like, you know, what we need to, what our response. So that's why I think the sort of Tikkun thing still sort of stands, mm-hmm. that by not, like, necessarily giving them, like, you know, a full, like, platform and maybe, like, creating, like, a certain degree of capacity about what the sort of, like, critiques of the sort of system are, that sort of, like, makes it, obviously it's problematic, but it prevents it being sort of recuperated into the sort of, like, next stage of, like, improvement of the, because, I mean, I think in a way, like, Cyber Knights would love to have, like, a sort of system where anyone who wants can sort of disrupt it, because that just builds, it's like, I don't know.
But
does that make sense? I don't know.
It does, but when you're talking about things disrupting, you made reference like people taking the streets or whatever. But if we understand Cyber Knights and understand spectacular roles and biopower, people taking the streets aren't actually creating any kind of noise. It's just something that's supposed to happen. So I don't know if viewing it as feeding off of these noises of feedback, if we to categorize those things as noise might not be particularly true, because it's just something repeating itself again. There's nothing chaotic about it.
True, but even, I think with you brought up the idea of insuring the RNC against basically, you know, huge, well, there's the element of, like, you know, insuring it against, like, violation of civil liberties, but that's also ensuring the sort of city that went on too. They were basically, like, they were completely prepared for, like, things to go out of control because A, they had insurance and it wouldn't really, and B, it would sort of, I guess, increase legitimacy maybe in a way. I don't know if that makes sense. But by having, like, you know, be like continuing the sort of, like, idea that, like, you know, the people behind the barricades are actually doing something that sort of, like, increases the amount of, I guess, legitimacy and sort of, like, idea of their sovereignty, even.
I have a question then. So, I mean, like, how... So when you say things like the system sort of functions by, like, sort of, like, this resistance is, like, great for it and noise is great for it, so, like, I don't know how that functions, like in practice, and it seems like it, like, functions, like, through, like, since we're talking basically a co-optation, right, it functions through, like, reflecting it back to us, right, so, like, the idea of, like, advertising reflects back to us, like, our new subcultural desires and crap like that, but the problem is that, like, it doesn't work. So, like, there's all this research showing that, like, advertising now is, like, fucking useless, and there's, like, the big, like, paranoia on, like, advertising agencies these days, like, among declining revenue is that, like, they can't actually demonstrate that any of this works. And so, like maybe the system is, like, picking up this resistance and reflecting it back, but, like, there's no evidence that it actually, like, really has any impact on the population, really, whatsoever. And, like, so, like, but obviously there is still control going on, so then, like, how does that circuit work? I'm curious about that.
I mean, I think that's what's the most scary to me about trying to think about how the system could be using noise against us is that, I mean, if you look at what second order cybernetics is saying, it's not even about like taking noise as a kind of disruption and somehow substantially changing it or transmuting it, right? So, like, this moment of co-optation, right, is not exactly what we'd be talking about here, right? We wouldn't be talking about, like, there's a noise and the system translates it into a quality, right, and then spits it back at us, right, or turns, you know, a form of life into a style or a milieu or something like that, but that actually the system, just as a system, right, might actually just need noise to be able to try things out, right? I mean, if you look at, like, the way Ashby's homeostat worked, it's a really good example of this. Where did that? Right, so Ashby's homeostat was basically, like, these four military gun plotters that were connected up in this totally one of the most world's most gloriously useless machines, right? It had these needles that could, you know, go between a certain range. And basically what it had was kind of very primitive, basically it had, like, a way to perturb these needles, right? These needles would start wildly
fluctuating, right? And what it had was a way of like adjusting. Basically, all of these were networked together,
right?
So each one of them would send signals to all the other ones, right? The outputs from all of these would control, the output would connect to input, which would then control the output, right? It was this hugely, hugely chaotic interlinked system, right? In which there's no central control and there's no design for kind of regulation, right? There's nothing in this system that says you really need to have a process of negative feedback in order to dampen these things. Actually, the interaction between the parts of the system was wildly, wildly chaotic, right? There was no design, there was no kind of structure of feedback there. And what Ashby did, the reason he said that, like, look, this is how you have, this is how you use variety to absorb variety, is basically you put like a random number generator. It was a very, very primitive kind of random number generator, right? But basically what would happen is that the system would basically, whenever any one of these individual nodes got out of whack and hit a certain threshold, right, that would turn on the output to another thing that would perturb some other element of the system, right? What it would also do was trigger this random number generator, right? Dice, right? And basically what it would do is then start randomly rejiggering the connections in the system, right? So the noise, right? The noise was precisely this randomness that was at the heart of the system. And what the system did was kind of draw on this noise, and not in any sort of way as content, right? Not in any sort of qualitative way, but purely as a way of saying, like, well, how can I rejigger myself? How can I rejigger myself? Let me try something else. Let me try something else. Let me try something else. And the effect was that this machine would, you know, you perturb it, you send these needles spinning out of control, and very, very, very quickly the machine would, by drawing on noise, by drawing on randomness, would find a way to maintain that equilibrium, right? So it's a different model of control than the cybernetic model, right? The cybernetic model is, right, you know, the thermostat. It's you're out of bounds, turn off, right? And this is more like you're out of bounds, do something. And so that to me is like where the kind of scariness of the possibility of noise, right, and the generation of noise being reintegrated in control comes in, is that we don't know, we might not have any idea what the vector is, right? It might not be this kind of process that's like intelligible to us as a process of, say, co-optation or of incorporation or subsumption or any of these kind of very qualitative moments, right, where we would be kind of folded back into the totality in a way that would be intelligible, right? It might be, you know, it might be that the empire precisely is dumb in this kind of setup, right? And we try and perturb empire, right? Yeah, maybe that perturbs empire, it wildly swings out of equilibrium, but maybe empire uses that perturbation to, like, you know, reestablish control on the other side of the planet, right? That's the level of the complexity of the system we might be talking about, and that to me is really scary. You know, that kind of even further decenters empire, right? Like, empire is no longer the product of a kind of technocratic vision of global regulation that's kind of held up as a model of faith, but empire becomes this kind of wildly chaotic, kind of psychotic mechanism that kind of is able to, like, reach homeostasis through this kind of very bizarre process of incorporating noise.
I guess, like, the optimistic thing, actually, I guess this whole idea of, like, noise and innovation is kind of even part of the self-narrative of, like, modern empire, but something that makes me optimistic, well, I still want to figure out how to save our cybernetic utopias, but, like, one thing, I was really uncomfortable with, like, their conclusions about what to do. Like, I really didn't like, it's not in this, but another thing they talk about, like, taking advantage of crises, like, they're like, oh, the North American anarchists were able to use New Orleans to, like, improve their organizing. And I just think that's messed up. Right? Like, it's not like long-term building connections. And, you know, I'm like, I don't really like that. And also, the increase of opacity, you talked about really early, you're like, or for me, I'm like, yeah, transparency is a value that we have, right? Like, or I have, and I don't know. And so in a system where a certain level of noise is tolerated or even accepted, there's no longer a need to, like, hide every last thing about yourself, right? In fact, it's okay to have, say, this storefront, because, and, like, actually what you observe in, like, just, like, normal history is that lots of things are tolerated all the time. It's only, like, when they pass a certain threshold do they get mysteriously disappeared. So, it means that, like, the tactics that they sort of dictate, I don't think are necessary, that it becomes possible to build models and not have it be entirely secret, and it's not necessary, like, these moments of crisis or destabilization are probably the same moments when empire does stuff. It has stuff it wants to do in those moments. So maybe like there's things that can happen in the background underneath the noise threshold that could work. So.
And also just historically, right now we know that common ground was actually infiltrated, right? Mm-hmm. So like, and by one of the lead organizers, right? Like, so. Let's hear it from Opacity, right?
Yeah, and hasn't the system figured out a way to like read through Opacity? So like, or this like really weird thing about the development of redaction marks in documents, and the way that the protocol developed to issue documents like on the Freedom of Information Act that have been redacted, and the logic is so. How you redact things, you're only allowed to redact things that are like extremely discreet and identifiable, but simultaneously, the material left has to be meaningful. So like, for example, if you have a statement of sentence like, Agent Don went to the facility, to the secret facility, you can't black out Agent Don, secret facility, and have like the as the only participle in the sentence, right? And like, so the idea is that like they figured out a way to make things work through Opacity, and like, so like you can have things like comprehensible documents released in an open fashion that are then meaningful, but obviously like not open in that real way.
Can I make sort of a couple of like big sort of disconnected observations? Or maybe slightly connected, and these would be a little pulling back slightly. I mean, I can't tell what the relationship of this text or even this conversation is exactly to what I'm going to say. But to what extent is it? I mean, it seems like there's an assumption here that, or at least there's an identification with, okay, the empire is control and rationality. And then the opposition is noise, right? So, I mean, to what extent is it maybe a mistake to even grant that like you were saying, it's sort of conception of itself, that the institutions of capitalist society or whatever are actually rational, or that they actually do engage in control in this kind of a way? So that would be to say, all right, and then that would say, like, what, is it even valid to look at society in this way as a system, as feedback, as a network. I mean, any of these like analogies or metaphors. I mean, I recommend any alternatives at the moment. But I mean, to what extent does like engaging in this language already? Wittgenstein has this wonderful line where he says that when he's talking about like the logical atomists in early 20th century analytic philosophy, but he's saying that. He says that we ended up predicating of the thing the analysis we were using to the telescope we were looking at, we thought was part of the thing we were discussing. So I mean, maybe in that sense, the kind of pessimistic positions to be drawn are sort of like a result of looking at it in this fashion. I mean, I'm sure really good arguments can be made for viewing society in with these kind of models. So I'm not just simply dismissing them, but and then the third thing, in the same respect, is, and this may be a little bit detached, is despite their like fierce criticism in this text of the existing left and the, you know, these traditions, the one thing that I think they don't escape, and in fact they even push it farther because they say that Marx and Bataille were both completely wrong to try to tie their analysis to something external like this. Laborers and some sense species being and whatever else and what is it in the tie of expenditure and so they push it even farther and they say that actually like you without any reference to anything you have to read the future society, the revolt in the future society, the entrails of the existing system, that the only way to understand any possible I'll just say movement, you know, in regards to our position towards this, is as something like imminently emerging out of this. I mean, see, what did start outward from the interior and all this kind of language. I mean, they're a little more. They problematize it maybe more because they reject the like some premises, but they're still dealing with value theory, which to me is sort of playing its role. So I mean, maybe yeah, those three things, like the way this kind of language like sort of works here, and then the question of why. I mean, and I would say this goes back 150 years at least, and it seems to be the one thing common to every variant of anarchist or progressive or anarchist thought is the idea that the, you know, by some alchemy, the flows and the movements of what is now will produce, you know, whatever else. And I mean, again, maybe that's, this is all a little made of the conversation, but anyway. I don't know, sun silence means I'm either, it's either genius or like bullshit, so somebody.
Well, I think your first point is interesting because one of the words that came to mind for me in thinking about all this is paranoia, and in a kind of, but I'm thinking about it, you know, the idea that this is the thing I think is interesting is all of this postulates one system that's closed, and so long as we have that idea in mind, then all these things become problematic. Right, but that's a kind of paranoid view, right? That there is a system; it's completely closed. It reaches around the world. It encompasses everything. And at that point, right, oscillations are just reincorporated within the system itself, right? If we assume there's system closure, but I don't know we can assume that. And I think that's kind of the paranoid view to say that there is system closure, that everything is, you know, contained within these linkages. And therefore everything will be restored to some kind of equilibrium within it. I don't know that's the case. And in fact, whenever I read texts like this, I always wonder, you know, to what degree there's a certain paranoia that's driving them and that informs the way that things are theorized. So I don't know. I think that's, as long as we do think in terms of just like the single system, I think we're always going to be thrown back upon these problems. I don't know. Are there multiple systems that are interacting? Is there closure? How do we know there's closure? I mean, those are the things that I don't know how to get beyond.
If there's not a single closed system, does that mean that the noise affects the system unequally in different parts?
I don't even know if the system isn't closed, does it even recognize noise? I mean, it seems to me that you have to have closure before you see anything that's disrupting the internal functioning of that system. So if it's not a closed system, if it's not totality, then does noise even exist in a sense?
I feel like, sorry, it doesn't have to be one single system that completely closes, or it could be the overlapping of incomplete systems.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones where they're overlapping, it just meshes. It doesn't matter if it's one thing that goes completely over it. Because
mm-hmm.
if everything is constantly encompassed by at least one thing, they could be different things, but those things interrelate to each other even so slightly.
Mm-hmm.
Then it doesn't matter if any single system is completely closed. Because where its shortcomings are, there is a different system which takes its place.
Well, but what if they're like radically different systems that don't even overlap? I mean, you know, there are, I think, you know, and I think this kind of goes back to, for me, this kind of goes back to the whole discussion earlier about disappearance and opacity. I mean, there are lots of ways to see systems that are functioning but aren't necessarily visible, right? And aren't necessarily visible to one another. You know, I think that's the interesting thing about the early theorizations of the internet is that it provides a kind of alternative highway for exchange. And those exchanges may not be visible. I mean, kind of the goal of total information awareness is to make all these systems visible to one another. But if they don't see each other, if they can't recognize each other, what's the nature of the interaction between them? And what's noise in one system may be not noise in the other. And there's no way to guarantee, even if there are multiple systems, that they're in any sort of interaction with each other. So, I don't know. I think that as long as we stay within the idea of like the system, which is, you know, what I keep hearing, then these problems are going to keep coming back. But I don't know that there is one system, you know?
But these systems have to interact with each other because these systems only exist as the singularities which they control. And any one of those singularities is impacted by multiple systems. So they do intersect in each person.
But if we're talking about cybernetic, they can, I mean, so like they can interact, then simultaneously they can turn themselves off. Like you can make the one and zero, right? And I guess that's sort of like the idea of like so noise can affect one part of the system which benefits from it, and another part of the system that would be harmed by it is going to click off. Maybe they'll completely annihilate. Like, so like you have like the evolutionary model, right? Where like in an ecosystem you can have some species develop entirely independently. And still propagate, right, and then feed into the larger ecosystem. And I guess that's sort of like one thing I was confused about with this whole thing was that like, so why are we privileging noise over message? Especially when you have things like memetics, where you have the idea of like the meme, where memes can virally propagate independently and interact, yet like when you talk about the way viruses propagate or like DNA propagates, like there's all this noise in the DNA strand, and only like this tiny part of it works, and then through random mutations, which are also noise, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, they keep going, they propagate, and like this all feeds into this like larger ecosystem, which may not be consciously interacting with like other parts of it. And then there's also the ability to like ignore the information. Okay, so I have this friend who like when he gets like pissed drunk, he like starts like spilling top secret information to me. He works for like the feds, right? For like I don't know if anyone saw like the Washington Post series we just did about like the massive like intelligence infrastructure. So he works for these companies, and all these companies do the same thing redundantly. And his job was to do nothing with like other 20 people to survey, like all they do is like watch screens upon screen of news covering every single thing relating to like the Middle East, right? Specifically, yeah, Afghanistan. And then they have to, then all these analysts then have to compile all these reports based on these little bits of news information. And then he's the dude who at the end of the day has to take a bunch of the news clips and make them look cool, which is he has to take all the explosions that happen and put them into like one slideshow. And then that gets then transformed to another thing, And so like, I don't want to drop this kind of thing in trouble, but like one of like the top commanders in NATO gets all his information through a literally 8-page PowerPoint slide of video, right? Which after feeding through this massive thing, then his aides look at it and then see that it doesn't match the daily protocol for information and send it back to my friend, who then has to completely rewrite it to match the thing that doesn't eventually have any of the original data. So like they take all the surveillance and then just like chuck it out at the end of the day. So it's like, yeah, there's all this noise, but maybe they don't care, maybe it's not necessary, sometimes it makes it through, sometimes it doesn't. And they can always like, you know, stop paying attention.
So I want to suggest something because it's coming up on 5 o'clock, it's like 4:45, and I know I'm on like hour 6 of seminar, which is, it's good training for the 2-day seminar that we're going to have in August. You know, I suspect Brian Holmes can go for, you know, seminar for like 30 hours in a stretch without batting an eye. But I think it would be nice to sort of figure out a way to kind of wrap the conversation up, and rather than having any one person kind of offer concluding words, I thought it might be nice to just kind of go around. And maybe if people, not to say like, you know, their definitive thesis on this, but just what questions does this prompt for you? Like, what are you going to look into now? What is bother, you know, having read this text, having sat through this whole discussion, having watched all the crazy people with beards and strange robots and all that, what's kind of on your mind? Like, what's on your agenda for sort of following up on this? And I will start so I don't have to go last, because if I point to somebody, I probably would wind up going last. Yeah, it's going that way. So Tiffany can have the last word, which I think is great. So I guess for me, the question I really have coming out of this essay is really trying to think very critically about the last, say, 10, 15 years of electronic media activism, and really think about what happened and why that didn't pay off in quite the way that it sort of, you know, elaborated itself as. You know, I've done a lot of work with like indie media, right? But when I started doing that work, like there was this, you know, this kind of world historical mission of sort of political transformation that was attached to this process of participatory media making. And I don't see that promise as being kept, and I actually see that promise as being kind of like kept in a way that is wildly divergent politically from the intent that was, you know, that was had, you know, looking at like the distance between, say, like, you know, these sort of early experiments of participatory online media and, say, like YouTube or Facebook, right? It's a very disconcerting kind of vertiginous gap there, and sort of using this kind of stuff to think about, well, what actually went wrong? What's the way forward? Is kind of where I'm at.
That's really cool, because I'm doing the same thing except 30 years earlier. So I've been doing some research on video in the 1970s, and the basically portable video began in 1968, and so you have this period of intense political activism at the same time as these new technologies, and so people pick them up and try to use them politically, and come up with all kinds of theories about how to use them politically that incorporate cybernetics, and then it doesn't really go anywhere. And so I've been looking at this in part in terms of sort of how do people think about technologies as part of political action. But there's also this question of what does this movement turn into, and how does that relate to what happened in the 90s, what happened in the 2000s, and I mean, there's sort of this obvious, like, all of these people are talking about how public access cable is going to be the salvation of America. And so whenever that comes up, there's this always obvious question, like, it took a long time, but YouTube does implement all the features they were looking for. Is it doing it, right? So to some extent, I'm sort of looking at the same set of questions, but in the counterculture of the 1970s. And since Gregory Bateson was part of this group, his boundary role in particular is something I want to work on more.
My final thought, maybe two final thoughts, are one that I'm glad that you brought this second order cybernetic stuff, because now I sort of have a feeling like, okay, well, maybe they have to condemn everyone on the left who believes in systems, but instead there's like a complex way that like people building systems powers and reinforces the system. Like, when does a labor union reinforce the world we live in, and when does it change it or whatever? And I think that's interesting and complicated, but not quite as dire as this. That's good. In terms of, and this question that you raised, John, about like how do we think about the 90s in terms of like a millennial like technological utopia around media, around technology, like someone like still doing technology, like how do you relate to this? What does it mean? And also, like, especially given that a lot of the stuff around cybernetics, it's less, you know, it's not people building systems, but these metaphors and systems learning, like, what does it teach us about modern culture and thinking around technology, how that influences political economy in general? So I think that's the project.
I was sitting in to listen to conversations. I didn't really have any input, and I was being an observer, but it was fun.
Yes, I come at it from a similar standpoint, but nonetheless, to say a few words. I see cybernetics as some form of like a biopolitical becoming of control, which I'm sure everyone's kind of found over here, especially with dealing with the Korean as we are. But I wanted to say very quickly that I'm very wary of looking at it from such a hyper theoretical perspective, and then engaging in arguments of that end up replicating the same function of what it is we're trying to critique. I think certainly there has to be some element of becoming and doing things ourselves, and to not do that and to only watch and only critique, I think is really no different than kind of this system of control that I think Takun is highlighting here.
I guess the one thing that resonated with me was like just like taking the tension, the like direness off like really briefly, but then like trying to bring it back by looking at like the trajectory or like potential of like cybernetics and all the theory that we've been discussing here, and just like a like what like just trying to go through my head like what boundaries like I found and like what questions that like leave these areas like open to think about new things, and especially like events and noise. But yeah, just like the potential and where we're going with our theory and like what, how it's going to be articulated, I guess.
I guess the biggest thing that I'm just sitting here pondering right now is defining noise. Like, what actual things are noise? And what actual things may even look like noise, but that's just another part of it, is that they look like noise. And trying to figure out what those things are. Because I guess it's the, you gotta try every bar and find the one that breaks. But so many of those things all look like potentials, but so much of it could not actually be noise. And this is so working under a much potentially naive idea that noise is a positive thing at all, an actual noise or anything like that, which we've discussed may not be the case whatsoever, but that's, I guess, the mindset I came into this room thinking, and now I'm sitting like, oh shit, damn. And so I'm just kind of sitting here just kind of zoning out on that. But actually figuring out what noise is, what role noise fills, and do different kinds of noise actually affect the system completely differently? Could there be more than one form of noise? Could there be noise one, noise two, that essentially are things that come outside these binary systems, but they are completely different entities. The only thing they have in common is that they are outside.
Cool. Well, yeah, I guess when I first read about cybernetics, I sort of came at it from like a utopian perspective, and then I sort of shifted slowly towards a more like dystopian sort of idea that they sort of present. But I think even within the sort of dystopian view, there's still like a lot of element of like elements of optimism and hope, just based on the fact that, well, it's not easy for like, you know, most folks to get access to information and to sort of like build systems or like counter systems or things like that that can, or even like interruptions. But when folks do, I guess there's like a capacity for like feedback and like resonance and stuff that can really like have like a significant effect. Like, for example, like memes is one thing I think you mentioned, but also just like playing off the like desire of, you know, like media and other like apparatuses that belong to the state to like, you know, suddenly like, you know, make a big thing out of small things. And like, for example, I don't know, even like the way the Communist Direction just got like catapulted into like, is like, is kind of an example of like cybernetics like doing its job, but also like while it's doing it, like providing other possibilities and just like maybe not allowing for it to be overthrown, but allowing folks to like have some fun, like culture jamming it or whatever. Which may be lame, but I think it's cool.
I was really hoping to come up with a good answer to all these questions because I have a paper due on Friday. And although I have not come up with any particular answers, I think that this discussion has convinced me that the genealogy of cybernetics is probably one of the most important things we can really be looking at now, because I think that in many ways the sorts of systems and the sorts of rationales that it puts forth really are part of the world now. I mean, it's out there. And the question is, you know, to what degree does it really affect us, and what does it mean, I think, most importantly. I don't know. I think that this question of, you know, this kind of final question that we've been pondering about, you know, the difference between closed systems and emergent systems and self-organization, I think that's really the key issue. And for me, it all kind of comes down to what's the status of the subject in these systems, what happens to the way that the subject is configured. And I don't have any good answers on that yet. I think it's a pretty open question. But
don't know. I think these are. I think this is a good seminar to have.
I guess I'm interested in ecology and thinking about that now, and also in relation to, like, I guess the period in, like, the early 70s when a lot of discourses about sustainability were emerging and being, like, influenced by cybernetics. Like, for example, I mean, even something which I think is problematic, like this Club of Rome report, The Limits to Growth, which kind of points out, like, the unsustainability of sort of endless expansion and growth in relation to resources and populations. But then, I mean, how that report and that, I don't know how it's, that was still based on this kind of idea of, like, this centralized, like, management of this world system, which is something that I would definitely want to reject. And, like, I'm trying to think, yeah, maybe how some of the more, like, second order cybernetics and ideas about self-organization and autonomy can relate to ecology now. I don't know if that makes sense, but I don't know what I'm thinking about.
Well, I guess the first thing that this seminar has maybe put in my mind is that I can't continue in my relatively terrible ignorance of recent French social philosophy any longer. I'm just kind of get those dusty Foucault books off my shelves and get back to them. But I guess the reason for that is because my main interest isn't in, you know, this is such, but I guess I was kind of hinting at this in my last comment, that something like the history of ideas or intellectual history and the way, but on a sort of philosophical plane, how really in a deep way society or human beings or the individual are conceived of and talked about by something like cybernetics, or by the critique of cybernetics, or by Foucault himself, or any of the things that have come up, and the kind of assumptions or premises that work on any, you know, that are necessary to any kind of conversation like that, and the way they work and the way they evolve, but particularly in regard to the last 200 years of revolutionary theory, and this is sort of representing some weird latest mutation, which, you know, your initial point, John, or earlier, much earlier point, that, you know, this is, it seems like a convincing account in a lot of ways of a sort of contemporary conjecture, but at the same time, you want to maintain this kind of view that there's some sort of hope in the things that you value and stuff like transparency, you know, you mentioned. So I guess to see, like, what, I mean, because I see this as in a very specific sort of position that's kind of like reeling from the catastrophe of the 20th century and the disaster of the collapse of the workers' movement and the everything else kind of ending up on the rocks. Yet at the same time, they want to maintain like a particular sort of like ultimately Marxian sort of like analysis. And it's interesting to see like the pull in that leads them to this like wildly optimistic position, I guess, because it's the coming insurrection, right? It's not the possible insurrection, but it's going to happen. So I guess, yeah, that's sort of where I'm left with this. But also just on a purely, like, factual basis. I mean, I knew about beer and some of this other stuff, and I was sort of aware of cybernetics as this weird, like, one of those weird sciences that never went anywhere and kind of got forgotten about or something like that. But, I mean, this is just to find out these particular trends is really exciting. Some new stuff for me.
Well, I make a lot of just participatory work, and so I've been working with like building systems to get people to participate. A lot of my work in the past few years, and so I've been thinking about this kind of stuff, but had not, you know, ever read anything about cybernetics until I found out about this seminar today. So I definitely want to read more about that, and I'm sort of, you know, rethinking a lot of the ideas of the sort of niceness that comes along with a lot of that work. Like, it's often very like idealistic in these like small utopian kind of moments, and there's never really any too much grit or any kind of friction or anything like that in it. So I think I've got some good material to start thinking about that some more. And then I've also been, there was an essay by George Jordan Crandall. I don't know if you guys have read. He's like a media theorist that teaches at UCSD. And he wrote an essay, I think it was called Inaccurate Repairs, and it was about watching one of the government's like terror drills. And he talks a lot about screech, which is kind of this idea of this sort of like this noise kind of thing. It's used as this like by the culture of fear to sort of like keep us kind of quiet and afraid. And so it's this like resonance of like, you know, witnessing that the government thinks that it's, you know, really important to be spending millions of dollars on these preparedness drills, you know. So if you just happen by one on the street, it's really fucking scary because they look real, you know. And I've gone to a couple of these, so I'm kind of thinking about that too, is like ways that the noise can be used for control.
I should have mostly interested in the question of noise that I throw at the end, which is good because I should have had fucking it. And sort of like it, some of the question that got posed at the tail end made me think a lot of like 90s rave culture cyber utopianism in a lot of respects. Because sort of like it was a community that simultaneously embraced like cybernetics like about as hard as you possibly can, while simultaneously being about noise and producing even like music out of noise in like a really aggressive way and like a really like fun way. And I'm wondering if that's something I want to take a look at sort of again. I mean, like even like the way like drum culture works seems to like feed into that kind of thing. It's like a disruption that like then causes like new shit to happen. And I'm kind of just looking at that again as a result of this.
Clayton, you can't escape.
No, but I'm not gonna say much. Since I was sitting here on my computer doing mostly a lot of work and really putting my ears to a lot of the attention, a lot of the stuff, like I haven't honestly read the essay that was mostly discussed, and so a lot of material, or at least the discourse of material, is kind of new to me. So I look really forward to reading more of it. But a lot of the stuff I feel like I'm more familiar with just through other discourse and through just daily life working and being involved with Rails, for example. It's put me into a lot of contact with myself, but
a lot of today, just by virtue of imagining this being a first exposure to a lot of this sort of discourse also was kind of went over my head and but I enjoyed it nonetheless. I thought there were a lot of ideas that I hadn't encountered before. I'm sort of fascinated by the, in general, how a very simple sort of elegant model of a human behavior, like the neural net or like, you know, the maximizing utilitarian individual, how these things get started and become powerful in society, because I think often they really don't necessarily do a good job. I mean, they're a part of the truth of how the world operates, but they're a part that gets focused on at any one given point and then takes on power because perhaps less because they're doing a better job of explaining predicting behavior than other models, but because they become a point of sort of social fascination and come into play as how we rationalize our behavior and our decisions to one another. And so they come into play as sort of like a card you can play to explain or support your action. And that this happens. And I see, you know, reading this document really kind of brought to mind a lot of applications that I see in the work that I do and the research that I do of this neural net sort of idea, feedback idea, and how that plays into the way that we legitimate social decision making that affects many people. I want to thank John for organizing this. It's really exciting. I'm as I mentioned, I'm part of the Red House Collective and not one of the major free school people, but it's still really exciting for me to see. Like, I think this is the first event of this nature that we've had here. So,
yeah.
I thought it was great.
And maybe just to close, I just want to say a few words about the free school, especially for people who are here in Baltimore. It's entirely volunteer run, and it's entirely community funded. We try and spread the funding as thin as possible across as many people as possible. So if you do like this kind of thing and would like to see this kind of thing, you can donate money online, you can throw a donation in that jar, or you can go down to Red Emma's and buy a free school t-shirt, you can come out to one of our fundraisers. We have a trivia night every once a month that raises a good deal of the revenue to keep this space open. And also, the space is here to be used. And if you go to freeschool.redemmas.org, you can propose a course. It can be everything from, you know, a once-a-week reading group to a one-off, one-hour discussion session to, you know, a three-day-long seminar space, you know, and the space is here to be used by anybody. So it's a resource, and it's something that, you know, people should, you know, it's not as if the free school is necessarily, like, I happen to be involved with the free school, and I happen to be the person who organized this seminar, but that doesn't mean that only people who are involved with running the free school are allowed to organize day-long seminars here. In fact, if it, you know, if there was a day-long seminar here happening with totally different groups of people every, you know, other week, I think everybody involved would be perfectly, perfectly thrilled to see that happen. And that's kind of the space for kind of unpredictable self-organization that we want to, and participatory dynamics that we want to see happen. But hopefully we're not causing some sort of regression into systems of control. But anyway, yeah, that's about what I want to say on the free school. Thank you everybody for coming. And also check out the Brian Holmes seminar if you're going to be around. It's going to be August 7th and 8th. And much the same kind of thing, except longer and more broad.